This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for July and August 2012. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature readings from poets in the current issue.
We're going to hear work from Adrian Matika.
The shirt was polyester with flyaway collars outlined in the forgotten astronomies of disco.
Saskia Hamilton.
I slept before a wall of books, and they calmed everything in the room, even their contents.
And from Natalie Shapiro.
The snack cakes of Smut Wonderland turn Alice smaller than her dress.
Then we'll talk with Jill Alexander Esbaum about mowing lawns.
Usually I'll start out by not doing it right at the edge, so I can just have that middle cut, like that's right through the hard grass.
Also in the July-August issue, we have poems by Kay Ryan, Tony Hoagland, Mark Levine, Jessica Greenbaum, and several other people. And it's the first time that we've had Lawrence Ferlinghetti in the magazine.
Not his poems, but paintings, along with his prose commentary on them.
We've got work that spans the whole trajectory of his career as a painter. He said he would have had a much more devoted career as a painter had he not been afflicted with poetry, right? Had it not been under siege from that. And the paintings are interesting. They negotiate the terrain between abstraction and figuration. He's clearly caught between these two things. He even mentions it in the notes that we include afterward.
Yeah, and some of the paintings have text included. There's an image of Ezra Pound, and the text painted right on the image of Pound says, "I have beaten out my exile," and Pound looks pretty beaten.
Yeah,
one
of the things that I loved about this, putting it together and working with it and working with him, was the sense you got of this whole life that had been lived in and for art.
Mm-hmm.
There's a wonderful kind of mixture of diffidence and confidence that comes across in what he says about painting. For instance, he talks about one painting called Manhattan Transit, which is adopted from the John Dos Passos book, Manhattan Transfer. And he talks about where he painted and the kinds of studios, and it's a very romantic feeling. And says, in those days before gesso came on the market, painters sized their raw canvas with rabbit skin glue. I heated the pot of glue on the coal stove. This is one of three or four abstract paintings I did in the 50s at a time when I really didn't know how to draw. It was an easy way out. How many other aspiring painters did the same?
Right.
And so that's diffident and downplaying his ability. But then he says, what I have in mind is art as the locus for fathoming man's fate.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful, confident assertion about what you can do with art. And both those things, I think, are necessary to make serious art.
Yeah, it's really true. I think what you might say the hallmark of his career in poetry is his enthusiasm, his energy, his robustness.
Yeah, he talks about wanting to paint light on the walls of life, right?
Yeah, and he says things in this piece like, paint like a fiend awake, obsessed.
Yeah.
He's an obsessed guy.
In our comment section, we have essays by Mary Ruffel, J.T. Barbarese, and Avril Curdy. But getting back to the poetry in the issue, Don, was there something you wanted to start with?
Yeah, there's a suite of poems called Unemployment by Mark Levine. You know, it's an important thing that's on a lot of people's mind, unemployment, and hard to write about and yet all too common. So the third one really stayed with me. I don't know why. It's a very straightforward poem, but it has a kind of vividness that I couldn't get it out of my head. And it goes like this. Out of cash, out of well-fitting trousers, out of soap and apples, out of pencils, out of my keeper's reach. I wish to set myself afire, but may not. This morning, last night, in the common room, I watched the administration of oxygen to one who had none, and I would not sit down, demanding to do so. Later, I happened on a man at the piano, and though I have happened 5 or 6 times on men at the piano, none moved his hand like this within the keys. I sat beside him, looking for a sound, a chest sound, not listening. I don't listen anymore. I make music, but I don't listen. This is sort of the frightening alienation and self-alienation of being out of work, of passing through a lot of strange and complicated things that go on in life as if they don't make sense anymore.
Yeah, everything is completely slowed down in this poem, and it's like an updated Bartleby the Scrivener. You know, I wish to set myself afire, but may not.
Right. Well, it's, you have all day to sort of decide. And when you have nothing but time on your hands and you have all day to decide, you may not decide. There may not be anything that you have to do.
Yeah.
But you do feel the necessity. We're sort of wired to do things and to see things and to think things and to make music. But, you know, here's a guy who's kind of having to tune it all out.
Yeah. There was a poem that I quite liked that leads off this issue by someone we've had in the magazine before, James Lasden. He's a British writer, but he lives in upstate New York and farms, and this poem is called The Blight. What's there to say? We didn't care for him much. And you can't exactly commiserate with someone you don't just not love, but almost, admit it, hate. So the news just hung over us like the dud summer weather we'd had. Rain since June, the lawn sodden, garden a bog, all slugs, late blight so bad, our sickened beefsteak vines, our sweet 100s, San Marzanos, the lot, yellowed half black before the fruit had set, which, when it did, began to bloat and rot before it ripened. But like I say, and not to speak ill of the dead, we just didn't care for him, which is probably all there is to be said. I like that. It reminds me of those Gottfried Benn poems that we've been running. It's just this dry, acerbic, and yet completely realistic vision of life. You know, it refuses to elegize something that's a fake feeling, you know.
Well, you have to be interested in a poem that starts off, what's there to say? And of course, he says what there is to say, which is basically, you know, this is all there is to be said.
It's wonderfully controlled formally, too. You know, it rhymes all the way through and sometimes subtly much in love, commiserate and hate. And you can feel the poem in your mouth bloat and rot. And
well, anybody who's tried to do gardening and isn't really good at it knows how that rhyme works, set and rot.
Yeah. Adrian Matika grew up in Indiana, and he'll return there this fall to teach creative writing at Indiana University in Bloomington.
Being a professor wasn't his first choice of career.
When I was a kid, I wanted to be an astronaut, but we were way too poor for such a thing. And I have terrible eyesight, too. I mean, you know, I mean, my contacts have contacts.
Matika's most recent book, Mixology, won an NAACP Image Award. His next book, The Big Smoke, is coming out next year. In the current issue, we have two poems from yet another book, one that's still taking shape.
Matika began the book after a visit to the McDonald Observatory in Texas. The trip reignited his childhood love for the stars, but while he intended to write a book about astronomy, the poems, as he told us, had their own trajectories.
I just kept trying to write about the stars and kept writing about how poor we were.
Every memory of stargazing was also a memory of being broke.
When I was really young, we lived in this neighborhood and the richest person around was the drug dealer. And the first time, I'm positive that I saw the stars before this, but the first time I recall seeing the stars was when he let us hang out at his house playing Atari on his projection screen and forgot to kick us out. And so I heard my mom yelling outside, and I went out, and it was nighttime, and I saw the stars. It must have been 7 or 8.
The poem you're about to hear comes out of another memory of a very special shirt. It's called Map to the Stars.
A Schwinn ride away, Eagledale Plaza. Shopping strip of busted walkways, crooked parking spaces nicked like the lines on the sides of somebody's mom-barbered head. Anchored by the Piccadilly Disco, where a shootout was guaranteed every weekend. Those gun claps, coughing stars shot from sideways guns, shiny enough to light the way for anyone willing to keep a head up long enough to see. Not me. I bought the Star Map shirt for 15 cents at the Value Village next to the Piccadilly during the daytime. The shirt was polyester with flyaway collars outlined in the forgotten astronomies of disco. The shirt's washed out points of light, arranged in horse and hero shapes, and I rocked it in places neither horse nor hero hung out. Polyester is made from polyethylene and catches fire easily like wings near a thrift store sun. Polyethylene used in shampoo bottles, gun cases, and those grocery sacks skidding like upended stars across the parking lot. There are more kinds of stars in this universe than salt granules on drive-through fries. Too many stars, lessening and swelling with each pedal pump away from the Value Village as the electric billboard above flashes first one DUI attorney, then another who speaks Spanish, so the sky above is constantly chattering like the biggest disco ball ever.
When I read this, I thought oddly of Seamus Heaney. I think we think of things as being more poetic if you grow up in a pastoral, rural environment, you know, and Heaney was famous for bringing that kind of material into English poetry, and Here you've got lines like, there are more kinds of stars in this universe than salt granules on drive-through fries, mm-hmm. which is wonderful.
Yeah.
You make that, you bring that constellation right down into your life of going to the drive-through
right. window. And making poetry out of polyester.
Yeah.
But the, you know, the kind of irony in it that he described in the introduction there really is quite poignant. You know, when you hear Map to the Stars, you might think, you know, map to
Beverly Hills.
Like Beverly Hills,
right.
yeah. Where a map to the stars above, which again sounds so peaceful and lovely, and his ambition to go out into space. And the poem is wonderfully earthbound. I mean, you know.
Yeah,
this is like the
earthbound.
Poet laureate of the strip mall here. Yeah. We've all seen Value Villages, but he is able to string together these little points of his own landscape and invest them with the kind of glittering thing you would expect to find in stars. But he yeah. finds them here.
Crooked parking spaces nicked like the lines on the sides of somebody's mom-barbered head.
Yeah, it's really fabulous. And then, you know, of course, the biggest disco ball ever. I mean, just pulling these images from the world around us is something poets always want to do, but this guy's really done it here.
Saskia Hamilton teaches at Barnard College in New York. We have three of her poems in the July issue, and one of them tells the story of a very difficult time.
There was a death of a child in our family some years ago. So that's what the poem is haunted by.
Hamilton told us around that time she went to a lecture by Christopher Ricks, the British literary critic.
He said this extraordinary thing about the ineffable is everywhere in language and very close to the ground. And I've been discussing it with a friend of mine who is a Miltonist.
The Milton scholar and Saskia Hamilton agreed that what Ricks said about the ineffable in language reminded them of mist. And recall this passage at the end of Paradise Lost when Adam and Eve leave paradise.
All in bright array the cherubim descended. On the ground, gliding meteorious, as evening mist risen from a river or the marish glides and gathers ground fast at the laborer's heel, homeward returning.
This poem takes its title from that passage. It's called On the Ground.
When the collie saw the child break from the crowd, he gave chase. And since they both were border crossers, they left this world. We were then made of, affronted by silence. The train passed post 5, Paris, late arrival, no luck, no enlarging commentary magnified in any glass. The ineffable is everywhere in language, the speaker had said, in the huge hall where I sat amongst coffers, students, in the late February of that year, at the end of a sinuous inquiry on sense and sound. And very close to the ground, he'd said. Like mist risen above the feet of animals in a far field north of here.
Well, it's sad, and yet there's something in this poem that refuses to let go. It is clinging to some sort of persistent presence of this child at the end of this poem, I think. And not incredibly. I mean, the poem makes that seem some kind of possibility, as if there was presence persisting in reality, even if it's only persisting as grief.
Mm-hmm. Just being able to take solace, not only from great poetry like Milton's, but from what is said about it by a literary critic, sort of connects a lot of dots. I mean, I think a lot of readers of poetry and poets themselves nowadays look askance at literary criticism as being a kind of professionalized, rarefied atmosphere in which poems don't really breathe. But here, you have a poet who has reached out to language that not only helps her cope, but helps her live and live to articulate this grief that the poem describes. It gets her out of herself. It sort of lifts her out and helps her plant her feet back on the ground.
And the poem fuses, actually, these different kinds of experience, right? The experience of literature, of reading, and then
yeah.
the experience that you have in life of loss and love and... It's a rarity to find those two things fused so closely in a poem. Let's hear another poem from Saskia Hamilton. This one is also about the things that we don't say. But while On the Ground was about things that are nearly impossible to say, this one is actually about the things one chooses not to say.
The title of the poem has a lot of consonants.
I'm half Dutch. So the title of this poem is Zwijgen, which is a Dutch word, a verb that means to fall silent. William the Silent, who liberated the Netherlands from Spanish rule, was known as Willem de Zwijger, which means William the Silent. And so te zwijg, to fall silent, as I said, it's an active verb.
Here's the poem.
Zwijgen. I slept before a wall of books, and they calmed everything in the room, even their contents, even me, woken by the cold and thrill, and still, they said, like the Dutch verb for falling silent that English has no accommodation for in the attics and rafters of its intimacies.
I love this. I've thought about it many times since I first read it. I thought about it actually at a cookout the other night. You were there with your family, and it was a part of a conversation I overheard, but I heard people saying, oh, I don't think anyone reads such and such. I didn't hear who they were talking about. And then someone said, I think it was Jackie, your wife, who said, oh, no one reads anything. We're the only refugees in this place here. And I thought of this poem because anybody who reads a lot, and maybe particularly poetry, does so with a sense, you can't do it without a sense of loneliness, because there's not that many people relative to your life that are as passionate about it.
And yeah,
it can be a really heartening and thrilling thing to come across an experience of presence like this, and also consolation and solitude and consciousness, and to have it given back to you, reflected mm-hmm. back to you, something that you've experienced so deeply. And Rilke once described being in love as an experience of adjacent solitude. I think he had his own self-exonerating reasons for right. doing that. But it's a good way of thinking about it, and it's a good way of thinking about reading poetry too, because it's a comforting thought to think of this person being comforted by these books, right?
Yeah, then. Yeah. And you can picture that.
Yeah.
I mean, you can picture taking a nap or something surrounded by books. That is almost, on the one hand, it's a womb-like feeling. You're just with your books. But what the books really do in their silence as they sit on the shelf is that they open up. I mean, she has this brilliant word in here, accommodation.
Like the Dutch verb for falling silent that English has no accommodation for.
Terrific word for what happens. We accommodate our books. Our books accommodate us. I mean, these things give us places to live. And yet books and silence are things that are stashed away, attics and rafters, a long way from the rack and bone shop of the heart, it seems to me. This is a much more appealing and probably, I think, even truer vision of what these books and poems can do for us.
Yeah, the attics and rafters of its intimacies.
Yeah.
Natalie Shapiro is a poet based here in Chicago. Her poems have appeared in The Believer, The New Republic, The Kenyon Review, as well as previously in poetry. And we have another poem by her in the July-August issue.
The poem is called Your Other Heart, and Shapiro began to write it after she went to a film festival in Chicago and saw, of all things, an X-rated Alice in Wonderland musical.
Yeah, I missed that one.
I didn't know about it. As you can imagine, the film took some liberties with the original.
You know, in the regular Lewis Carroll version and sort of more faithful movie adaptations, Alice eats this little cake and it makes her really small. But in the X-rated version, the same thing happens, except her dress doesn't shrink down. So she just becomes this very tiny, naked person in the middle of all of this fabric.
Shapiro says the image gave her the opportunity she'd been looking for, which was a way to write a poem about sex and lonesomeness. It's called Your Other Heart.
Mossy and thumping, bare of logic, red. Why do they say your other head and not your other heart? The snack cakes of Smut Wonderland turn Alice smaller than her dress. She stirs, nude in the folds of so much baby blue. To think they called this lesser art. I ate mostly orders then, and you were thinking with your other heart. I took in a dog, the way some might take in a dress. I had become just skin. It coughed. I cried for it to stop. I fed it meat, its malady recurrent and untreatable. I had to give it up, like some bum body part whose incidental benefit the human form has out-evolved. Don't start. That dog. I called it help, and I cried for it.
I like poems like this that manage to treat their grief lightly.
Right? It's, very lightly.
Yeah.
The snack cakes of Smut Wonderland.
Right. Well, how about that opening? Mossy, yeah. Bear of logic, red. What did they? Why do they say your other head and not your other heart? yeah, this is a funny poem, but it has, I mean, it is veined with sorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, I cried for it. Even that's a double phrase because there's a cry of longing and want and lust. And yet at the end here, I called it help and I cried for it. You can't tell what that cry is.
Yeah. You know, it strikes me, and this is another thing we get from poems where they sort of illuminate things that we don't even think about ordinarily. You know that expression, don't start. The poem has taught me that what happens is when somebody says don't start, that's when it starts.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
that's just the beginning. And, you know, this dog, the image of the dog, it's quite frightening.
It coughed. I cried for it to stop. I fed it meat, its malady recurrent and untreatable.
There's a devastating image in Ann Carson's poem, The Glass Essay, mm-hmm. where she compares herself to a baboon. You know, that she's so right. She's so obsessed with this man that, you know, then sex becomes the only way that they can connect. I mean, it's a devastating bit in that, but what I think is a great poem. And this poem reminded me of that because it's your body demanding things that are trying to get things that your mind has closed off from, you know. And there's this tension there.
Yeah.
Also in the July-August issue, we have a section of short prose pieces called The Poetry of Other Things. We asked poets to write about something, anything that they wanted, other than poetry.
So we have Michael Hoffman writing about his family going separate ways when he was a child, Michael Robbins writing about his cat Perdita, Sarah Lindsay writing about elephants that paint,
Robin Schiff about a soap opera, Ron Silliman about Willie Mays, and Jill Alexander Essbaum about mowing lawns.
Jill Alexander Essbaum found herself short of cash, let's say, and she's been cutting grass when she's not writing poems down there in Austin, Texas. Jill, how much do you charge for that?
It depends. I have a friend rate and a not friend rate. Maybe usually it's about $40, $50.
Yeah.
Well, you should cut poets a little break there.
No, poets could mow their own lawns.
I think they do.
I think they do, too.
So is there something especially appealing about mowing, and why do you do it?
Well, it's easy. I don't have to think that much while I'm doing it, except don't run over my foot or rocks or, you know, don't hurt myself, which I have done before. And I can put on my headphones and think about other things. And I kind of like to sweat. You know, it feels good to me. It feels cleansing, and it makes me kind of feel badass, you know, when I'm out there and, you know, everybody else is playing tennis or, you know, sipping
or writing poetry,
juleps or whatever, writing poems. And I'm, you know, out there with my gloves on and looking really frightful. And I enjoy it. You know how, like, when you're vacuuming your house and it's really messy and you run the vacuum cleaner and then there's this line of clean carpet or clean floor and then you pull it back and you're like, oh, there's that nice line. But this is how I sort of feel when I'm mowing the lawn. And usually I'll start out by not doing it right at the edge. So I can just have that middle cut, like that's right through the hard grass.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. I like having the one thing that's flat and clean or mowed against the messy bits.
When you started doing all this lawn mowing, you had some problems. Can you tell us about those?
Some problems. Like, I was poor. Don't you mean? No, it was terrible. I did bad math, and I hadn't counted in some bills and factored in when some paychecks and some contracts were going to get signed. I literally woke up one day and said, holy fuck, where's my money? And I emailed and called a bunch of people, and first I was like, can I babysit your kids? And do you need me to bake some pie? I mean, I don't know. I was thinking about everything, baking pies and editing people's manuscripts, which I did, but I always undercharge for that too. Somebody asked if I wanted to mow their lawn, and I did that. I don't know. It's neat. Nobody else, well, other people, obviously other people do it, but none of my friends do it.
Yeah.
You didn't have the option like T.S. Eliot, you know, working in a bank.
No. I can't count.
I guess if you're messing up your bills, you don't want to be in a bank. Why don't you give our listeners a sense of it? Just read a little bit, because this is so sharply written, this piece, and maybe the digression that's in the middle there.
Okay. A digression. Years ago, when I had the scratch to spend and the itch to spend it, I paid a man to do my lawn. This is not a euphemism. When he wasn't tending lawns, he roped calves. He was a cowboy. When you gonna come ride my horse, Jill? he asked each time he came over. This might have been a euphemism. He stopped working for me when we started going out because, as a rule, one should never date someone she pays. He was nice enough and good-looking, but it didn't last. And I never rode his horse, one way or the other.
Now, you said something intriguing to me. You said that, you know, you love the almost the formality of mowing lawns. Is there a connection between that and poetry for you? Are you able to work on poems when you're doing this? And do you see any? Your poems are very sort of chiseled, wrought things.
That's really interesting that you say that, because when I first started to think about working on this piece, I was trying to find the poem link. And I think I found one, but it wasn't nearly as interesting to write about. I'm a slob, like in general in life and clearly in my checkbook. So things are sprawled and spilled and go everywhere. So my lawn gets really nasty and messy. And there's something about cleaning it, you know, and edging it and bagging all the stuff that isn't as lovely to look at. And, you know, so you have all this waste. And, you know, when I'm writing a poem, I talk to myself about corseting it, like, you know, wrapping it up in a corset and like tying that shit real tight, you know, to make it look good. And when I'm thinking about mowing compared to writing poetry, you know, this idea of like there's a form already laid out for you, and it's the form of your landscape. Here is a sidewalk, here is a tree, here's, you know, your neighbor's lawn. There's an organization that's already presented itself, you know, like a sonnet, right? And so I think that there's that. And my check.
You see, people think writing poems is a very cushy thing to do. You know, you've done some teaching, as most poets do, which sounds easier than this lawn mowing stuff. But if poets can't teach, what's a good job for them to do that pays reasonably well and gives you time to write? Not everybody's going to want to mow the lawn, having heard this description. So what other options are there?
That's my racket.
Yeah, move in on your business. But what other kinds of things should they do?
You know what? I mean, everybody's different, obviously. But I like to do things where I can be alone and think and listen in a way that doesn't involve what I'm doing with my hands. Right? You know, so you're engaging like different parts of your body. Like when I walk, I write in my head or, you know, I talk to myself. People carry their cell phones around with you. They have little recorders on it. And I speak into it. When I'm doing the lawn, I'll stop and, you know, I'll have a line or a thought and I'll stop and I'll talk into my little recorder or whatever. You know, if I'm like babysitting or something, I can't really think. I have to be like, kids, please quit playing with the knives. So I would say for me, it would be anything that I can also do in the back of my mind, the running dialogue with myself or the listening to the music of the language that I encounter other people speaking. Because when you teach, it's very fertile, you know, you can get a lot out of your students, but whatever's happening is happening in front of the whole classroom. You don't have that private space to pull back. When you're doing something like mowing lawns or, I don't know, painting, cleaning, I've cleaned houses before. That's another thing to do. It's not mindless. I mean, you have to know how to do things. And, you know, your body has its mind, but you can also think at the same time.
Well, thanks so much for talking to us today, Jill.
Hey, thanks.
You can read Jill Alexander Esbaum's essay and everything else you heard on this program in the July-August 2012 issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox with help from Posey Gruner.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scher.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.